Welcome to episode 28 of Practical Defense, Tournaments as Training Devices. Welcome back to another episode of Practical Defense. I'm your host, Alex Addix. First, I'd like to introduce our guest host this week, Paul Wilson. Paul is one of the co-hosts of Karate Cafe, and that is the first ever traditional martial arts podcast. Paul also runs his own dojo out of Dallas, Texas. So, welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alex. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on. Now, I've been so busy with things that I actually forgot to bring up my own important milestone. Practical Defense has been online now for a year. It just blows me away. My first posting was back in August 12 of 2007, and this show is going online August 24th. And I know I've been doing this for a while now, but the whole year thing kind of caught me by surprise.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly a year will go by when, you know, you're trying to produce a show. And, you know, every week or 2 weeks, it's, you know, they just add up really quickly. And I kind of came to your show kind of late, which was actually kind of good to me because that means I have almost an entire year of shows to listen to.
Well, thanks. Also, before we get into our main topic, I want to recognize all the great feedback I've received from episode 27, where we covered some of the child protection issues. And this was, I focused mainly the first one on ages 3 and 5. And it really was pretty popular, and I've been asked to cover other age groups.
I think that show is a fantastic show for, you don't even have to have a martial arts background, just a defensive background. Whenever we do our self-defense seminars, like for parents, we always get a really good response on it because I think that's an area that people don't really think about so much. And just having simple, easy tips are a big help to parents that have enough to think about during their day.
Oh, yeah. In fact, a lot of people have been sending in their own child safety protocols, you know, things that they use to keep their own kids safer. You know, that's absolutely fantastic, and I want more. So everyone out there, please send in your personal child safety measures, and what I'll do is I'll compile them, I'll split them up into the proper age groups, and then I'll start including them in shows. And I'm looking for things like bus stop procedures, what to do if you're late picking up your kids, what are your kids supposed to be doing then, whether or not they can go home with other parents, if they're going for sleepovers, you know, either, you know, going away to somebody else's house for a sleepover or if you're hosting the sleepover, and just anything and everything. And you can send those suggestions to podcast@alexaddix.com. Also, I would like to let everyone know that I have actually finally seen Clerks. I got a lot of emails saying, I can't believe we haven't seen Clerks yet. Well, I went out, I rented it, I watched it, and it was pretty good.
And now Alex is no longer dead to me.
Yeah, Paul was one of the people that sent me hate mail about not seeing Clerks.
I wouldn't have called it hate mail, more just a friendly, gentle prodding.
Well, I guess. It depends upon how you define certain things.
It's easier to be tough when you're 1,000 miles away, so...
Yeah. I found it was pretty good. It was definitely a first movie. I found the dialogue to be very stiff. It was something that maybe, like, I hate to say it, maybe a high schooler would have written. But
I think he actually did write it when he was in high school.
Okay, well, that would make sense. That would make sense. Because it wasn't – I'm a big Kevin Smith fan. I like all of his other stuff. But this one was just so – the dialogue was so rigid. But, you know, the movie grew on me, and I liked it by the end.
Well, you got to look at it like a – you know, for our martial arts friends, it's like the first martial arts style. May not have been the best, may have just been getting your foot in the water, and now, you know, that was his foundation that he built everything else on.
Yeah, and it allowed him to move on and do other things. I think he's even writing, like, X-Men now or something, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's written a lot of comic books.
Yeah.
He wrote Daredevil, and he wrote a couple other things, and they also wanted him to, he wrote a script for a Superman movie that they shot down.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, because he actually is an avowed comic book fan. He actually sold his comic book collection to make Clerks. So, and he's a huge comic book fan. So I think maybe they just didn't want someone who actually understood the source material to write it or something.
I guess that wouldn't make too much sense. It wouldn't go on with a good script that would appeal to a mass audience or something.
Exactly.
Well, actually, so let's move on to let's get back to martial arts and training and things. Our topic this week is tournaments. And Paul and I have been talking about this for a little while now, and then this whole Olympic thing came up. And I'm certain pretty much everyone has heard by now that especially if they're into martial arts, that the Cuban Taekwondo player has been banned from the Olympics. And he's not banned just from the Olympics, but he's also banned from the WTF, or the World Taekwondo Federation.
Yeah, that was pretty shocking. And if you've seen the video for it, it's pretty sad from all the stuff he did in the you know, all the protests and whatnot. And then just to lash out and actually physically attack a referee is just, that's shocking.
It blew me away. He got upset at the ref for making a call, and he kicked him in the head. It was actually a double kick. It was a hook kick followed by a roundhouse. And I was stunned. I couldn't believe it had happened. One of the things I like about the Olympics is that despite professional sports and things like that, people are out there to make money. But the Olympics, they really try and make the Olympic athletes role models. And I think that's why they came down so hard on this guy. It wasn't just a fine. It wasn't just a temporary ban or loss of medal. They actually booted him from everything. And I think that's wonderful.
Absolutely. Got to have a zero tolerance policy and a thing like that, because whether or not they want to, they're an actual, you know, role model. They're, you know, a role model from the competition sense, from, you know, martial art instructors, Taekwondo instructors in general want to be able to point and say, look, you know, these are guys and they're in Olympics, and, you know, it's a relatively newish Olympic sport. You know, I think they're trying to get, you know, karate in general as an Olympic sport, and you know, it makes martial arts look bad at a base level.
Oh yeah, it really damaged the sport.
I mean, and the reason that, you know, it wasn't like the guy was attacked. It was just, you know, the guy didn't think he had enough time, or the ref was grading too harshly, and it's, you know, it's part of the contract as a competitor that, you know, you have to obey to what the referee says.
The guy ran out. What happened was the guy claimed an injury to his leg, and in the middle of a fight, and he was winning by like 2-1 or something like that, or he was actually up on points, and he claimed an injury to his foot. And by the rules, you're allowed 1 minute to be treated on the floor, and then you can continue the fight. And I remember I was watching the videos of this, and the referee was standing over him saying, "Okay, 30 seconds, 20 seconds, 10 seconds, 6." He was counting down. And then when he hit 1 minute, you know, 1 minute passed, he said, "Okay, disqualified, you're done." Because the guy was still sitting on the floor being rapped by his coach. And then the guy got up and had the big argument and said, "Oh, you didn't give me enough time. You're being too strict." And he was like, "I was counting down. You had plenty of warning." And then the guy laid out and kicked him in the head. Didn't actually knock him down, but it did give him a bloody lip, and he needed stitches in his lip.
Yeah, and I mean, those poor little judges. I mean, I don't know if that judge had any, you know, martial art experience, but, you know, I mean, it's not like he's expecting it. You know, referees have kind of an aura around them that you just don't mess with them. And that guy apparently didn't want to play by the rules.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, I am certain that this action set the Cuban Taekwondo team back at least a decade. And because points are awarded subjectively by the judges. I mean, it's not like fencing where you're wired up so that when the blade touches you, it sets off an alarm and it can be scored, because those attacks are faster than the eye. These things are still judged by eye. And I don't think that any international judge in any competition is ever going to give the benefit of the doubt to any Cuban player for another decade. With actions like that, why would you?
Yeah, and furthermore, you know, any competitor that goes up against a Cuban competitor, and, you know, maybe even because of this incident, you know, competitors aren't going to trust one another. You know, you never know if that guy's just going to not be happy with the call and hit you.
Yeah, I mean, after the fact, I mean, I've been hit in the head with my back turned after the judge called break in some of the tournaments I fought in. It was a full force hit, too. It was pretty nasty. We had gotten tied up, and we'd clinched, and the judge came in and called break, and so we were kind of extricating ourselves. And so as the way to get out of it, I kind of turned, and so my back was turned to him, and then I hear this, felt this tap on my head and was like, "What?" And then this full-blown hook punch. My back was turned, I couldn't feel, but it felt like just a full-on whack into the side of the head, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was an instant headache, and the refs, you know, awarded me a point as a penalty against him, but I think he should have been probably disqualified for it, but they just gave the point to me. And then after that, he didn't score any other points. I had the sympathy of the judges, and I beat him 5-2. We were tied 2-2 at that point. Then I'd scored 3 straight in a row.
And you had a little impetus on your side, too. Payback and whatnot.
Yeah, well, it was actually for the first and second place fight for the trophy. And so he was actually really pretty good. But yeah, the judges weren't going to give him anything. And fortunately, the last point was absolutely no question about it. He was squared up against me, and I put a sidekick right into his belly, and it bent him over. So at least I'm happy that the last point was everybody in the audience could tell that it was a point.
Yeah, and that's what we like to see. You know, nice clean technique in there, and you know, it showed that. You know, I guess maybe in an idealized way in my head, you know, it shows them like this is the way you compete. You know, nice clean technique. You know, straight ahead. Don't let anything rattle you. You know, and play by the rules.
What we're going to do now is we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about tournaments, but from a perspective of the benefits they can offer to your training. We'll be right back. So this week, our topic is about training and using martial arts tournaments as part of your training program. Now, I used to compete in tournaments all the time as when I was younger. I mean, 3 times a month. Practically every weekend, my father would take us to tournaments and we'd compete all over the Southwest. We'd go Arizona, Southern California, Northern California, pretty much anything that's within driving distance or if we had friends living by. You know, back in those days, back in the early 80s and mid 80s, the tournaments were a lot larger than they are today. It's really the whole landscape has changed quite a bit. And I always competed in sparring. You know, I never was into the weapons or the kata forms. They just weren't really quite my thing. The granddaddy of all the tournaments was, without a doubt, the Long Beach International Karate Championships. And at one time, the Internationals, as they're called, was the largest amateur karate tournament in the world and is probably still one of the longest-running, if not the longest-running, karate tournament. It was started by My Art's founder, Senior Grandmaster Ed Parker, back in the 60s. And this is the same tournament that Bruce Lee did his famous one-inch punch-in demonstration. And that, with some introductions from Grandmaster Parker, you know, got his movie career started. All the greats competed in this tournament. Chuck Norris, Joe Louis, Benny Riquidez, Roy Kirban. They were all here for years. And this tournament used to be so large that it took up the entire Long Beach Sports Arena. I remember going in and they would have, you know, 40 or 50 rings going, and the stands would be filled with competitors all the way up to the top. And it was hard to find a seat. You know, when I competed in the mid-80s, even in the kids' categories, you know, 10, 11, 12, 14, 13, 14, 15, 15, 16, I had 150 people in my category. 150 kids. And so this was the tournament every year, and it was just massive. But, you know, after Grandmaster Parker died in 91, the tournament kind of fell on hard times. You know, it's still running, and it's still huge compared to most tournaments. And, you know, there's still a strong international presence. I was at this year's tournament. It was back on August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and it still takes the whole weekend. People still flying from all over the world to compete here. You know, I saw teams from Okinawa, China, Japan, Korea, a ton from South America, and the, you know, ever-present delegation from Ireland. And it still takes 3 days, and they had 25 rings running all day long.
That must have been a circus.
It was really, it brought back so many memories. But yeah, it was big. I mean, they took up the Long Beach Convention Center this time. And yeah, 25 rings, and it was tough to figure out where they were. I didn't quite understand the way that they were numbered, but they had 3 rows of rings going. So if your ring was in the middle, it was really kind of hard to get to because they had the area cordoned off to keep out just the parents and the spectators and things like that. But it was still big and still interesting.
Man, that would have been just a sight to see. Even now, yeah, I agree. You know, the tournaments aren't as big as they used to be for the most part. But that was the granddaddy of all tournaments, you know, for competitors and for martial artists in general.
Oh yeah, back in the day, there was nothing like the Internationals, and we had to go. It was a badge of honor. I mean, we actually had a special place in our uniforms we put, because the Internationals, when you compete there, they actually give you a patch that you can put on your gi or your gear, and everyone used to wear them on their uniforms. And if you had an Internationals patch and you fought in other tournaments, it was always like, ooh, wait, that guy competed at the Internationals.
Kind of like you got made.
Yeah, sort of like it. And if you had 5 or 6, it was like, oh boy, that guy's a pro. Because there are people that, you know, even today, there are studios and dojos that focus almost exclusively on fighting in tournaments. So you have your traditional tournaments or dojos, you have your, you know, self-defense type places that you train, and then there are these dojos that really focus on competition and the competition side of things. And those are the ones you go in, you see all the trophies on all the walls and things like that. But the Internationals was cool. They actually branched out quite a bit. They had separate categories for American Kenpo and sparring. Then they had a Taekwondo sparring. They had grappling. It's the first time I've seen grappling. They had traditional uniform grappling as well as the MMA-type uniform grappling. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that must have been a great just to see, you know, different styles competing next to one another and being able to compare and contrast them just by watching them.
Well, that's what kind of gave me the whole idea for this episode was I'm looking around going, this is just an incredible opportunity to train. I mean, how often can you work with other people from other styles and even from other countries where they don't even necessarily speak the same language? You know, think of the things that you could pick up and get experience with. And that's what gave me the whole idea for this running this episode.
Yeah, that's when Alex contacted me about this episode, that's one of the things that was really interesting to it, because, you know, as a traditional martial artist, we don't do a lot of tournaments. And I've done a few when I was like a Shodan, I started going to a couple of tournaments. But it really got me thinking again about tournaments as a training tool.
Yeah, because, and this is what we're going to get into, is that, and I know you're an advocate of sparring, but you need to spar to prepare for self-defense in a street confrontation. You need to know what it feels like to get hit. You need to know what it's like to try and hit someone who's trying to avoid you and hit you back. And there really is no substitute for it. And I always say, you know, punching the air is nice. Punching the heavy bags is great for tactile feedback. But there is no substitute for simulated combat.
No, there's absolutely not. And you hit the nail on the head. And one thing that I always try and emphasize is, you know, you need to feel what it feels like to get hit. You know, I know some schools that don't even hit, you know, bags and stuff. Yeah, they're just punching air. So you really need to know what it's like to hit somebody. But, you know, the tail of the tape is when you get hit. And, you know, when someone pops you in the nose, how is your body going to react? You know, when someone, you know, sweeps your leg, how is your body going to react? But then the flip side is also how you react when things don't go correctly. You know, when that technique that you practiced 1,000 times, you know, but actually applied it to another human didn't work.
I'm still shocked when you said just all they do is punch the air. I mean, as soon as you actually hit something, if all you do is punch the air, the first time you hit something solid, you're going to break your wrist if you put any force behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, or you're going to hyperextend your elbow in the course of doing it, or you're not going to generate any power because you've overextended. You don't understand the ranging unless you're actually hitting something.
Yeah, we're in total agreement. There is no substitute for sparring. But that's the other thing is, you know, if your studio has contact sparring, that's fantastic. But what happens over time is that you get complacent. You get comfortable inside this little bubble inside your studio. You know, you may line up against Bob, and you've been training for a few years with Bob, and you know that he favors his left leg for front kicks, and he's got a great back fist. So what happens? You adjust. You adjust to his fighting style. And then next may be, you know, Frank. And you know Frank's a headhunter. So you pull up your guard a little higher, expose your ribs because you know he's going to be going for your nose. And what happens after a while is that you get so used to this that the sparring loses meaning. You learn what everyone does, and it becomes so familiar that the sparring is no longer useful to you.
Yeah, and the real landmine in that whole situation is, you know, on some nights you may be a little more tired, you may not really be into it that night, and so you, instead of pushing yourself, you actually end up picking and choosing, like, okay, I'm going to spar with that guy because I know he's not going to give me that much of a run for my money. Or, you know, she's really going to, you know, my legs are kind of hurting, so she's not really going to, you know, make me kick a lot, you know. And you fall into that, you know, rut of picking your targets, you know, deciding who you're going to spar with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I also remember one time in my Hapkido class where we did a lot of sparring. This particular morning, the instructor told us to experiment. So he said, experiment, try something new, you know, take it easy on each other and just, you know, see, feel things out, experiment. So when we did our rotations, we lined up and we would rotate. And when I lined up against this instructor, I used a Kenpo spinning rear leg sweep on him. What happened was it freaked him out. He even got mad at me. And you know, he asked me, was that a Hapkido move? And I was like, no. And he says, well, don't do it. And he said, but you said to experiment with new things. And this is something that I'll never forget that he said. He said, that was not new to you, and it wasn't Hapkido, so don't do it again. And I was like, that is, you know, he was the instructor, he was running the class, so I just said, yes, sir. But in my mind, I'm going, that was one of the stupidest things I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those you attacked me wrong sort of scenarios.
Oh, absolutely. It was like, okay, so what's going to happen on the street? You don't, on the street, you're going to face anybody and anything at any time. You're not going to face, I said, you know what? You're not a Hapkido, so I'm not going to fight you. What?
Yeah.
You know, come up with a hooking punch because I need to do 5 swords.
Yeah. Okay, I'm really good at weapons, so you have to come at me with a bow.
Yes, but
otherwise, I'm just going to go home.
Yeah. So that it was so mind-boggling to me that this person who was, you know, second or third Don at the time was, what do you mean? You said try stuff that was new, and here I was trying to help you out and trying to experiment. Because I, at the time, I was training both in Kenpo and Hapkido. So in Hapkido in the morning, I was doing Kenpo at night. And by the way, that really hurt my brain. It just blew me away. But it brought home a very good point, was that you don't face your own style and your own friends out on the street.
Yeah. You know, and even, you know, within your dojo, you'll have people that, you know, just when you told me that story, it reminded me of a guy that we used to train with. We were both green belts together, and we were both about the same size, about the same height. And we were, because we do the same thing, we'd rotate through, but we'd kind of end up sparring each other all the time because we had kind of a small class at that time. And then there was a certain point where I knew what he was going to do. I knew what he was going to do. So I would start, because I'd been training with some Taekwondo guys and kind of learned some high kicks. So I started throwing high kicks at him because we don't do high kicks. And he was like, what are you doing? You know, you can't attack me like that. And I'm like, well, you know, why not? It's a kick, you know, and actually, you know, there was a ton of Taekwondo schools in our town. And I was like, you know, if someone ever attacked you that had any training, chances are they're Taekwondo guys. And, you know, we might want to have some sort of comprehension on how to defend against a higher kick or a spin kick or anything. But later on, we were sparring again, and we do a lot of trapping. And I trapped him, and I kind of did a hip throw on him. And again, he was, what are you doing? And I was, you know, I'm taking you to the ground. And then, but the funniest thing was our head instructor at the time, whenever you would spar with him, you would almost always end up on the ground. Yeah. And, we had another guy who was a brown belt in our style, but he was a black belt in judo, and he always took people to the ground, you know, and he never wanted to spar with that guy because he'd always get taken to the ground. And he literally said, well, when someone attacks me, it's just going to be really clean, and we're all going to be up here, and it's going to be punching a kick, and it's going to be over with. And I'm like, and even at a green belt, I was like, you're high.
Yeah.
And you can't dictate how someone's going to attack you.
Yeah. The real world is dirty, ugly, and nasty. It is not Jet Li or Jackie Chan in the movies. Even the people that have 20, 30 years experience, it still looks sloppy. It's just ugly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I mean, the best you can hope for is maybe kind of dictate the area you're going to be attacked in. Like, you know, if you're situationally aware and you know you're going to be attacked, if maybe you can, you know, get your back against a wall or, you know, something like that, or, you know, just try and pick your ground. But that's maybe the best it's going to be. Generally, it's just going to be somebody jumping on you.
The other thing is that, you know, moving around and doing different styles and fighting different people and sparring with different people helps build confidence as well. When I spar a lot, people always say, hey, Alex, you always look so calm. Nothing ever seems to rattle you, no matter what happens. And I'm thinking it's because I've seen it all before. And they're like, well, how did you get the experience? And it's like, well, I used to do tournaments a lot. But because of tournaments, I got used to standing in front of strange people every weekend and fighting. That has been some of the best experience for real world stuff that I can think of.
And also to bring it back to, you know, a tournament and like something like, you know, the Long Beach Internationals, is there's a lot of people watching you, as well as the judges, as well as that person who's actually punching and kicking at you. And that's a whole other level of stress that, you know, a lot of people don't take into account that a tournament would help with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're just the other competitors standing there. You got, you know, just, you know, 150 other kids looking at you, not to mention, you know, all their parents and their family and their coaches and everybody else. So it's, you have an audience of 500 at you know, back in the day.
And those people are, some of those people are looking at you. And so you have that, you know, I don't want to look like a fool factor. You know, I'm going to look like a fool depending on how badly I'm beaten. This guy's got a huge, you know, cheering section that's all cheering for them. So, you know, and you have to be able to focus all that stuff out. And you have to kind of do the same thing in a defensive situation, you know, and from a training situation is, you know, you need to block out all those things and focus on the, you know, the fist at hand.
One of the things that I always felt whenever I got into a confrontation, I've always been able to talk my way out of it, but a lot of it has just been through body language and confidence that the other people have just, you know, decided I wasn't worth the effort. Also, I'm also a really big guy. But after facing so many complete strangers in tournament situations, you know, looking at somebody, some guy that I had never met before on the school ground, on the street, in a bar or whatever, it didn't faze me because I was so used to going up against complete strangers. And because I think a lot of the time, because I had that confidence and I had that body language, they're like, you know what? This guy isn't afraid. He's not macho. Because I'm not macho. I don't go looking for fights. But I'm just like, you know what? You know, let's talk about this. Let's work something out. Let's move around it. But I never showed fear because there wasn't any. There was concern. But I wasn't like, oh my God, there are three of them and I've never seen these guys before. I have no idea what they're going to do. It's like, I face that every weekend. So what competing in tournaments allows you to do is it allows you to face people that you've never faced before, and you build a confidence around that. And that will really help you out on the street. And it forces you to adapt immediately to unfamiliar opponents. Now that sounds to me like it's a lot more realistic than, you know, competing in their same dojo and sparring with people, the same people you've sparred with, the same six people for 10 years.
Yeah, it does. And it gives you the confidence, but then on the flip side, I think it also gives you the humility to, you know, yeah, because you're fighting people you don't know, you're training against people you've never seen before, a style you may not have seen before. And, you know, if you will go walking around, if you're the best fighter in your school, that's great. But that doesn't necessarily translate to being the best fighter in the world or, you know, on the sidewalk in front of your school. And if you train against people who have different levels, different types, different intensities of training, you know, that's, you're probably going to get beat. You know, I mean, I never won a sparring competition, you know, and I don't think I'm anywhere near the best fighter or even a defensive fighter that I know. But I've got that humility because of that situation that kind of opened my eyes to going like, yeah, I'm not that great.
Yeah, that's actually an excellent point. I used to compete every weekend and I probably lost as many as I won. And when you, especially as an adult, are you going and adding tournaments to your training regime? You can't look at a loss as being a failure. A loss is a learning experience. You know, okay, what you tried didn't work. Or this guy was so incredibly fast that you just couldn't get anything in. And so you need to realize that, wow, okay, that's a serious vulnerability I have. And I need to adapt to that because there are going to be people that are faster than you. And in fact, Grandmaster Parker always used to say is that, I don't care who you are, there is always somebody bigger, better, stronger, and faster than you are. That is just the way life is. No one is ever number one.
Yeah, that's what I always tell my students. That I said, there's always going to be somebody better than you, and chances are that's the person you're going to run into.
Oh, and if you're looking for it, he'll show up tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there's no better learning experience than, you know, the School of Hard Knocks, but that's the place to learn it. Yeah, I mean, I would much rather learn my lesson in the dojo or on a tournament floor than, you know, in a back alley somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because tournaments actually are a semi-safe environment. Now, I say semi-safe because, you know, you're fighting people that you have no idea how wild they are. But it's semi-safe because you're using pads, there are rules, and there are judges and refs around to enforce the rules and step in if something starts to get out of control. But from personal experience, never let your guard down, ever. You know, I still remember that recent full force hit to the head, you know, with my back turned, was like, that still was like, whoa, where did that come from? So another thing about tournaments that teaches you is it teaches you to explode and react immediately. You know, because the next time that your dojo lines up for sparring, you know, take a second to look around and see how people start out. You know, I'm willing to bet that after the instructor calls start, that people kind of mill around, they kind of feel each other out, they put out a few trial kicks, put out a few punches, before actually engaging and doing real, you know, combinations and exchanging blows. And the thing is, that is not how it happens on the street.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've told my students when we're doing self-defense, especially. And I actually, you know, and the way I learned it was sparring. I was at a friend's school in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Somebody was testing and they were like, do you want to spar? And I'm like, well, I don't have any of my gear. So they gave me gear. And I was like, because I hadn't sparred in quite a while. And in our dojo, usually when it's, you know, just kind of, you know, honestly testing, sparring, stuff like that, it's whoever's being tested is the one who has to be the aggressor. For some reason, not quite sure why, but, and they did the same way. Anyway, so they were tested for the brown belt. We lined up and they said go. And I was just kind of hanging out because I always, it doesn't matter. I usually fight defensively, so I don't like to react first. And she was doing the same thing. She was kind of circling around. So we kind of circled around for about 15 seconds. And then Tommy, the instructor, stopped it. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, you know, I want her to attack me. And he's like, what's her test? You know, light her up. I'm like, okay. And when we said go again, I just boom, right out, you know, kick, punch. And nothing, a couple things connected, but, you know, it wasn't clear. But it threw her off her game so heavily that she was used to that give and take section, that little, you know, feeling them out, a couple trial kicks. And from there, I was kind of like, yeah, I never want to do that again. It's always got to be, if you're going to do it, you need to do it now.
Yeah.
You can't wait.
Absolutely. Because that's what happens in the real world. It is fast. It is intense and instantaneous. I mean, they say that, hand-to-hand combat on the street takes, you know, less than 30 seconds and a knife fight is less than 10 seconds. But one of the things that happens in tournaments is when the judge says go, the action happens immediately. Because usually the person that is more aggressive is the one that lands the point first. So it conditions you to react and get aggressive and move. And we're talking 0 to 150% effort instantly. And there is no waiting. Either you're attacking now, as soon as he said go, or you're defending against that attack immediately. And those, you know, when you look at them from that point of perspective, is, you know, something that's really important for real world situations, because they are going to happen. There's no warm up. There's, you know, sometimes there's posturing, but when the strikes happen and they're fast and they're furious.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a reason why they call it a sucker punch. You know, it's not because they just, you know, walk up and line up and wait for someone to say Hajime. You know, they're just going to come swinging or kicking or swinging a, you know, stick at you or a knife. You're going to have no preamble. And if you're lucky, you have no preamble. And working from a defensive standpoint, you know, if I always tell them, I never spar in my dojo from a toe-to-toe situation. It's always someone's attacking you. Because I think, you know, and there are caveats to everything. But my standpoint is, if you've got time to talk back and forth, you got time to run. You know, so, you know, in a tournament, you don't have that. You know, it's pretty much go. You've got to get your points. You've got to, you know, you size up your opponent, but, you know, you don't have that time, anything other than a training scenario. So using that immediate explosion, that immediate jump into something is like 90% of defending yourself, as being able to do a technique right now.
And it's totally unexpected. It's a totally random attack. You have no idea what's going to happen. You don't know if it's going to start with a kick, if it's going to be a fake, if it's going to be a punch. Actually, back in, you know, the tournaments these days, they actually put the lines out, at least at the internationals they did. They had them a lot wider. You know, back when I was younger and probably a little more nimble, I could actually start from the starting line and get a jumping front kick over to the other guy as soon as they actually called start. I could actually reach him. I can't reach him anymore, but that used to be one of my opening strikes was this, you know, he said go, and I just jumped. And it was very hard to defend against because it's a very straightforward, direct kick. And so the guy either had to move out of the way or block it, or he was going to get hit. And so it was a good opening move, but it was fast and instantaneous, and it was, you know, there. And so you have to react. You can't be docile in a tournament. It forces you to react now, or you're going to lose points.
Yeah, you know, and that's actually, you know, for the person who is the receiver of that technique, when someone's exploding once, that would be just like it would be from a defensive standpoint when someone just comes at you, you know, and that's your training opportunity of being able to react to it.
Exactly.
You know, and then the flip side is that's your training opportunity of the person who's actually doing it, because, you know, I don't advocate so much attacking first in most situations, but, you know, who's to say that reaction, that's going to help your reaction time on the flip side.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I've had grandmasters that have been both ways. Grandmaster Han for Hapkido was very passive. In fact, he never taught techniques that were first strike techniques. Whereas Grandmaster Parker, one of his quotes is, you know, action is faster than reaction. So, and he was very big on the preemptive strike. He was like, if you know the guy's going to hit you, hit him first. You know, I grew up with both. And so I'm not quite certain where I stand on it. I see the logic of both.
Yeah, and I'm the same way. And a lot of people, I've had, you know, other traditionally type people kind of, you know, karate's for defense only. I say, I agree. you know. I said, but self-defense is for defending yourself, you know. And I've had a couple of my students who have asked me, said, like, you know, and they've had situations where, you know, they had people in their face, they've had people, you know, yelling at them, they've had people, you know, and we've talked about the various scenarios, and he asked, like, you know, when do you hit first? And I was like, I can't tell you. You know, it has to be when you feel that there is absolutely nothing, you know, no way out of it, and they're going to attack, you know, and so you've got to do something. The first strike, you know, is a preemptive strike is maybe the best of all the options.
You might be able to end it right then and there and not let it escalate to something worse, like drawing a weapon or anything else. So, yeah, it's you know, any street confrontation is extremely fluid, and sometimes the right answer is a preemptive strike, and sometimes it's not. Yeah. And it all depends upon the situation.
And there's permutations on top of that of, like, you know, preemptive strike was, you know, hit somebody in the throat. No, you don't hit them in the throat. You know, yeah. Smash their knee. Well, maybe you don't have to smash their knee, but you can still react preemptively to cut it off at the pass. Yeah. And a lot of times what I tell people is, like, you know, if you have to do it, make sure no one sees you, you know, because that way it's, you know, they're worried against yours.
And stopping on some guy's knee and destroying his knee might be very hard to explain to the police if the guy didn't swing first.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, he was going to swing at me. Really? Okay, how do you prove that in court?
Yeah, you know, he was digging into his pocket to get a knife. Oh, no, he was digging his pocket to give you some spare change because he thought you were a bomb or something. Yeah, right. You know, that's where, you know, it's kind of one of those, it's a subjective thing. You know, it's, you know, when do you feel threatened? And so to come back to the topic, if you're feeling indecisive about doing your technique, that might be the part where that's where you're going to lose it because, you know, they reacted first. From a training standpoint, your reaction speed is slower because of that.
You know, absolutely.
That's the benefit of that kind of training.
And in the street, and just like in a tournament, you don't have much of a choice. Well, I guess in a tournament, you could just say, okay, I quit and walk away. I actually had that happen once. I was so much bigger than the other kid. His coach said, you know what? He's not going to fight him. So he pulled his student out, wouldn't let him spar me in a tournament. But I mean, that's kind of the point about the whole thing in tournaments and sparring, is that this coach had no idea who I was. He just saw that I was so much bigger than his student, he didn't want to take the risk. I've always had really, really good control. You know, I've always been much larger than everybody else, but I'm one of those really gentle guys. And so the instructors would actually, whenever we had a new student, especially women, they would always have me line up and help and train with the woman because they know that I had perfect control and no one would ever get hurt and there would never be too much force. But here I was at the tournament, you know, I'm head and shoulders above this other kid. I probably had 60, 70 pounds on him. And the coach was like, I have no idea who this guy is. So I'm not going to take the risk. And he just pulled his student out. But that's the type of thing, again, in tournaments, you have no idea who you're going to be facing. And that is where the learning happens. And that's why these things can really be very good training aids.
Yeah, you know, even in a dojo visit, you know, it's kind of friendly, you know, but it's not... You know, you don't know quite who you're getting, but in a tournament, you don't know who you're coming up against, you know, unless you're, you know, you go into tournaments all the time, then you may run in against the same people on a regular basis. In a tournament situation, yeah, you don't know what school you're coming from. You may be an international school, maybe a school from the other side of the country. Somebody you may never see again, and you've never seen them train. You've never seen their kick. You've never seen their punch. So that's where a tournament can really help.
Oh, absolutely. So I think we've just about covered everything. Any last thoughts before we take a break?
No, I think that'll about do it.
Okay, we'll be right back. So consider competing in an occasional tournament as a supplement to your training because it can really add a lot to your experience. You know, you need to spar, and you need to be able to face complete strangers, and you need to be able to face different styles. And finally, you need to confront highly aggressive and explosive attacks and be able to deal with them. And these are things that you can get from your local martial arts tournaments.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Because even having a, you know, just a friendly competition, you know, just trap backyard training, it's not the same because you still have the, you know, the pressure of the competition, you know, that's going to drive it, that adrenaline, that something that you don't get just from, you know, friendly exchanging of techniques when there's, you know, dare I say it, you know, a medal on the line or, you know, a trophy, it puts a little more, you know, a little more fire to it.
Oh, yeah. And it takes you out of your element, puts you into something new and different, which is always good for your training.
Absolutely.
All right, Paul. Well, it was fantastic having you on. I really appreciate you coming by and helping out with us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I'm flattered that you had me come on, and I did love your show. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thanks. And I say, you know, coming by, I meant that virtually because you're in Dallas. We're doing this over Skype.
Yeah, you flew me in and put me up at the Beverly Hills Hilton. I appreciate that.
No problem. So if people want to find you, how would they find you?
Well, they can find me through my website, www.karate-dojo.org, O-R-G, or they can email me at paul@karatedojo.org, or they can catch our podcast over at karatecafe.com.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and hopefully you guys will put another episode sometime soon.
Yeah, we actually have one in the can. We just haven't quite got around to putting it up yet.
Well, cool. I look forward to listening to it. And for everyone else, if you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexaddicts.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Well, that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions and commentary, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe.